Welcome to How to Raise Happy, Healthy, Self-Confident Children with best-selling authors Brian Tracy and Betty Youngs. Brian Tracy is one of the world's leading authorities on the development of human potential and personal effectiveness. Hundreds of thousands of men, women, and teenagers have used his ideas to improve the quality of their lives. Brian is the number one best-selling audio program author in the world and the author of a number of books, including Maximum Achievement, published by Simon & Schuster. He is also the creator of A Gift of Self-Esteem, a video-based program to help teenagers realize their full potential. Brian and his wife Barbara are the parents of four children. They live in San Diego, California, where Brian is the chairman of Brian Tracy International. Dr. Betty B. Youngs is a nationally known psychologist, educator, and best-selling author. She has worked with youth, parents, and educators in several countries. She is a former Teacher of the Year and professor at San Diego State University. She is the author of books for both parents and youth, including Stress in Children and Helping Your Teenager, a Parent's Survival Guide to the Adolescent Years. Betty has one daughter and lives in San Diego, California.
Session 1, The Challenges of Parenting. Parents today face challenges that barely existed a decade ago. In this session, Betty and Brian talk about what those challenges are and what you can do to make your child a winner.
Hello, I'm Brian Tracy, and I'm reminded of the story told by the experienced parent who said, "Before I had children, I had six theories about raising children. Now I've got six children and no theories."
That's great, Brian. Hi, I'm Betty Youngs, and you know, Brian, I'm reminded of the ancient Chinese proverb that says, "Every child is like an empty sheet of paper on which every passerby leaves a mark." And that's really true when it relates to raising happy and self-confident and healthy children, because what we do and what we say and what others say and do really impact our children.
Yes. I think we have to make something clear right at the beginning, is there's two major sets of factors that are going to determine how your child turns out. And the first set of factors are what you might call temperamental factors. Doctors have identified 9 different temperaments that children have, and these temperaments can make a child easy to love or difficult to love. They can make a child easy to live with or difficult to live with. And every parent who's had more than one child knows that they can be very, very different. So there's many factors that are genetic or predetermined, but there's the whole set of other factors which you can call environmental factors or nurture factors. And these are the things that you can impact. These are the things that you can affect in raising your children to be happy, healthy, and self-confident.
And I think an overall theme in our program today, Brian, is just to give parents courage and the hope that they can affect their children in very many positive ways, and we're going to be focusing on those ways.
That's right. We're going to give you dozens and dozens and dozens of really first-class, tested, proven, practical, many cases simple ideas that you can use to have a tremendously positive impact on how your children feel, how they act, how you get along with them, and more than anything else, how they turn out when they grow up.
You know, Brian, I think this is a good place to tell our listeners about our children. You have young children, and I have a teenage child, and I think that's a really nice balance here. I've been parenting for a little over a decade now, and have worked with parents throughout the nation.
The overarching role of parenting is where we should begin, is what is the role of parenting? If you know where you're aiming for, you're very likely to get there at the end of the journey. And the role of parenting, based on what most experts working in child development today agree upon, is to nurture your children and raise them with high self-esteem. Now, why should this be the core role? Simply this, that if you raise your children with high self-esteem and high levels of self-confidence, so they feel terrific about themselves, so they really feel that they're capable of taking on the world when they leave you and go out into the world, then you've succeeded as a parent. And it's not money, it's not education, it's not the things that you give them, it's how they feel about themselves inside. So we're going to focus throughout this entire program on giving you countless tools and techniques that you can use to really make your children feel terrific about themselves.
This is not without reward, because when our children feel very empowered and feel powerful, they do well. And in turn, it makes us feel good about our own role. All of us have a need to feel purposeful, that we matter. And when we connect with our children in a very significant way, they show it. And that, in turn, gives us a lot of feedback about our own effectiveness as a parent.
It's worthwhile noting, by the way, is that you can't build more self-esteem in your children than you have for yourself. One of the major problems that we have in child raising today is that many parents don't really like themselves very much. They don't respect themselves. Deep down inside, they don't consider themselves to be valuable and worthwhile. And you know the old saying, the fruit never falls too far from the tree. What it means is that we always tend to instill in our children the values and attitudes and behaviors that we have in ourselves. But here's the good point, is that everything that we do to raise our children's self-esteem, to make them feel better about themselves, simultaneously raises our own. Every single successful act of parenting that we engage in causes us to feel better about ourselves. So investing time and effort in building your children into high-performance young people is actually going to have an effect on building you into a high-performance adult.
And that's a good place to look at what self-esteem really is, Brian, because self-esteem is an underlying feeling of a collection of a number of experiences that we've had in our life. Self-esteem really is our reputation that we hold of ourselves. And a very important part of this, especially as it relates to nurturing our children, is to make sure that the price tag children put on themselves is a very high positive one, that their sense of personhood is up there so that they can achieve and so that they can take on the world, so that they can meet the challenges that they're going to meet along the way of growing up.
In our Phoenix seminar, we define self-esteem as how much you like and respect yourself, how much you consider yourself to be a valuable and worthwhile person. And we encourage people to say over and over again, I like myself. I like myself. I genuinely like and accept myself unconditionally. And we find that you can measure your own self-esteem by how comfortable you feel saying, I like myself, or even better, I love myself. And you can measure your children's self-esteem by asking them to say, I like myself. And you will find that sometimes they can say it easily, and sometimes they'll have a terrible time saying it, which will tell you something very important about them.
You know, Brian, one of our reasons for wanting to do a program for parents was to not only help parents look at the very important aspect of increasing their child's sense of self-esteem so that a child will accomplish and achieve and feel powerful as a person, but also so that we could help parents look at the other components of self-esteem. Because in children, it's not just how they feel about themselves, it's how others treat them. Really, most importantly, how we treat them and accord them, that is also an important part of their self-esteem. And there are a couple of areas that we'll be talking about and expanding upon in this program, but those are physical security and physical safety and emotional security and identity and belonging and a sense of purpose and achievement.
One of the things we know is that although children come into the world with a certain constellation of temperamental faculties, intelligence and heredity and genetic structure that will determine their physical structure and their emotions, they come into the world very much like a blank slate in terms of their self-concept and self-esteem. And it's the way they're treated by their parents in their formative years that tells them whether or not they are valuable and worthwhile. If you laugh at a child when they do something, the child thinks he's funny. If you hug the child thinks I'm lovable. If you play with the child thinks I'm valuable and important. So we know that self-esteem rests on a foundation of self-acceptance, is that we feel free to like ourselves to the degree to which we feel we are totally accepted, warts and all, as Shakespeare said, by the important people in our lives.
That's such good news, because that means that if your child does have low self-esteem, or if you've been through crises in your life that have lowered your child's sense of self-esteem, or even your own, that you can change it. You can make a decision to change that sense of self, that sense of perception, those inner messages that keep coming into the child that determine your self-worth.
Yes, and we know that this lack of self-acceptance often arises as the result of destructive criticism. Sometimes parents feel that they're helping their child by giving their child feedback on their behavior. And sometimes the feedback is, don't do this, or stop that, or get away from here. But what the child takes in is not the verbal content of the message, but the emotional content. And what the child takes in is, I'm not good enough. I'm not likable. I'm not accepted. I'm rejected. My mommy and daddy don't consider me valuable. This is what causes a child to feel rejection. The rejection leads to low self-esteem. So when a parent finally understands this, the parent begins to phrase their messages to their children in far more positive and constructive terms.
Right, and we know that we do this because we want to create that inner language where a child is talking to himself, saying, I am worthwhile, I am purposeful, I am capable. And that's the underpinning of self-esteem.
Yes, and how do you achieve this? Well, the simplest of all terms is to go and focus on what makes your child feel important. Everything that you do that makes your child feel important, that makes your child feel valuable, smiling at your child, holding your child, hugging your child, even gazing at your child with warm eye contact, praising, encouraging, reinforcing your child, going for walks with your child, everything that conveys to the child that you feel that he or she is an important human being causes their self-esteem to go up.
When I wrote the book, Helping Your Teenager, A Parent's Guide to the Adolescent Years, we asked children across the nation what was really important, what they really wanted from their parents. And they provided a list for us that gives us insight into the needs of children. And these needs are very, very simple. And if we listen very closely, Brian, these are all internal needs. The first thing they said was, they said, I want my parent to think I'm somebody special. In other words, am I important to you or not?
How does the child know that the parent thinks that he or she is someone special? Well, the parent tells the child that he or she is important and special. The parent tells the child that I love you and that I care for you and I think that you're terrific. When we travel with our kids or when we go for walks with our kids, we're always telling them how lucky we feel we are because we got them as children. We feel that we're the luckiest parents in the world that we have such wonderful children. And they just beam, even though they may not be angels, they just beam because they feel like they're really somebody. What's the second one on the list?
The second one is, I want my parents to be warm and friendly to me, just like they are to those who phone or come to the door. Children see a contradiction in the way parents treat people who call and people who come to the door.
There's a wonderful line from Emmett Fox where he says, if you must be rude to strangers, but save your company manners for your family. And I think one of the marks of the fully mature adult is that they treat everybody the same. They don't have a particular personality or persona for people who are important and then another personality for people who are not important. They don't have an outside personality, an inside personality. They treat everybody pretty much the same. And that's what children want from their parents.
That's right, Brian. And the third thing that children said they wanted was that they wanted their parents to be more concerned, they said, about me. In other words, am I important? My daughter will say to me, Mom, I don't feel well today. Can I stay home from school? And I have to watch how I respond to that because what she's getting is not, is school important, but am I important?
Yes. Which means if they do have an ache or a pain or a concern or a worry, one thing that really conveys to them that they're important is when you stop and put down what you're doing and ask them, well, how do you feel? Or when did that start? Is you treat them as though they were very precious to you.
Another part of that is that we have to make sure that we value our children all of the years of their life. So yes. Many teenagers say to me, my dad's always telling me what he does for me. I wish he'd do less for me and more with me. In other words, young children get a lot of attention from parents, but many adolescents feel like their parents have lessened the amount of time and attention and care and love.
And an important point is that only when we become adults do our lives become 10% intellectual and 90% emotional. Up until the time we become adults, our lives are virtually 100% emotional. And it's the feeling component of the interaction. It's the emotional part of the relationship that's totally important to us. It's not the money. It's not the bicycles. It's not the car. So an answer like, go and soak your foot or go and sit down or go to bed early and so on. That's not what we want. We want the emotional response to our concern or to our hurt.
Right. You know, Brian, the fourth area was kids said, I want my parents to know the me that nobody knows. And you see, children are always growing and changing and growing and changing. So they're always very fresh with themselves. There's always a new person inside. And they have an idea that their friends may know them better or that their parents don't care to keep knowing.
Well, it's interesting. Every human being has a deep down desire to be known and fully understood by at least one other person. One of the reasons why we get married is so that we can spend our entire lives, if possible, getting to know and understand one other person. And I think of the title to that wonderful book, Please Understand Me. And I think that's what our children are saying to us in this. They're saying, please understand me. And of course, understanding me means you have to spend time with me. And not only that, you have to listen to me rather than talk to me.
Yes, you know, teens in particular say to me, I feel like I should wear a shirt that says IQ 110 because everyone says, how is your homework? How is your school life? Everyone relates to me as though I'm a student, but no one cares about the other part of me. And so again, they're asking, take the time to know me.
You know that when you listen intensely to a person, the person listened to's self-esteem goes up like a thermometer on a hot day, that you can actually raise self-esteem in people by listening attentively to them. And, of course, we'll talk about that in a later session.
Yes, and in fact, Brian, we'll spend a lot of time doing that, because if you listen to a child, you can diffuse a lot of anger. Sometimes they just want to lash out, and what they're really saying is, listen to me. You know, a young child says, watch me, Mommy, watch me, Daddy. And what they're saying is, give me your time and attention. And so it's a point worth developing.
What's the next point on that list?
Children said, I want to express my views and have those views be valued. In other words, do I count? Are you listening to me? Does my viewpoint matter? Do I have a say here? Am I important?
Isn't that interesting? Because the research at Harvard University concluded that one of the two factors that produced high-achieving young people was growing up in a democratic environment where the children's views were solicited and that they were respected. That doesn't mean the parents acted on what the children said. It just meant that the children were asked, what do you think about this? Or what do you think we should do here? Or what is your opinion? The idea of being brought up in a democratic environment, and that's exactly what children are telling us.
Yeah, you know, one of the ways we do that at our house is to pose a problem that's going on, that's a real problem in our lives, and say, and turn to Jennifer and say, Jennifer, how would you solve this? What would you do? In other words, to bring her out, to draw her out, to get her a viewpoint, and it's a very valuable one often, but she feels important as a result.
I often ask my children for advice on business questions. I say, this is the situation in our office. What would you do? And I try to make the description of the situation very simple, but it's absolutely amazing how insightful children are. They'll come up with very simple and correct answers. Then why don't you do this, Daddy? Or why don't you do that, Daddy? It reminds me of the story of the businessman who keeps coming home at night loaded with work and his briefcase full and bulging. And the little girl says, Mommy, why does Daddy bring so much work home? She said, well, honey, he can't get all his work done in the office. And she said, well, then why don't they put him in a slower class?
Right. Or it's like your daughter who said to you when you were posing a problem of so much work to do, she said, why don't you hire somebody to help you?
Yeah.
You know, just a very simple solution. And the sixth area was that kids said, I want to go to a school with other kids I relate to. And you see, Brian, children see parents as controlling this, like by buying a house in a certain area. Children see parents as very powerful people.
Then what they're saying is that I want you to be involved in the choice of where I get my education. Since you control where I go, I want you to take an active role and make sure that I go to a school where there are kids that are like the person I want to be.
Yeah, you know, later on we'll be talking about the nature of school. But many children find school to be a fearful place. And what they do is they turn that back to parents and basically in their mind say, how come you made this my reality?
That's right. Parents are responsible for those critical decisions.
The seventh area was children said, I want to be a part of a happy family. And I think that's exciting because children are able to say, this is a happy home place or this isn't.
You know, I've always said that you could measure the self-esteem of the children in a family by one single factor, and it is how much the family laughs together. Is that the measure of laughter is the determinant of the healthiness of a family, because laughter always arises spontaneously. You can't say, well, I'm going to laugh 10 minutes today. What happens is laughter occurs naturally when an environment has been created where people feel good about themselves.
Yeah, children see it as playtime, yeah. The amount of playfulness that parents
And children want to be in an environment where they can laugh a lot.
You know,
and
it really falls into the next area because kids said, I want my parents to lighten up.
That's right. Sometimes parents don't realize that they get far too serious about themselves in life. Someone once said, take life seriously, but never yourself. And I think that's good advice for parents.
The ninth area was children said, I want to learn more about my own emotions. I want to learn more about me, they said.
And the only way that a child can learn about their emotions is in a safe environment where their parent can help reflect back to them what they're saying. When the child says, I am mad about something, the parent can help them understand their emotions by saying, why do you feel this way? Or why do you think you're mad about this situation? And help the child articulate it. One of the things we know in psychology is that self-disclosure, the ability to talk honestly about what you really feel to one other person, is absolutely essential for mental health.
You know, in homes with high self-esteem, we find that children are able to express their emotions and then come back at a point and say, you know, I'm sorry, or this is what I really meant, or but they felt free to express themselves.
As opposed to repress them or holding them in for
That's
fear
right.
of punishment or,
That's right.
or criticism.
Or sometimes you see the view where children are to be heard, not seen, so to speak. Children who feel like they can talk about their fears or talk about their worries or concerns are more likely to feel that they belong to a home where emotions are an open and acceptable part of it.
Yes, and when a child is upset, what they need more than anything else is not to be talked to, but to be loved, to be held, to have the fact that they're feeling emotionally involved, respected by their parents.
Yes, I see. You know, loving and respecting children is a very key ingredient. This. And the last area was children said, I want to live in a world without war. And here again, children see parents as controlling this. They cited acts such as voting and so on. They saw parents so powerful that if parents really wanted to, they could make the world at peace. And these are the things that children wanted from parents.
Well, what they're saying more than anything else is that they want to have hope for the future. They want to believe that the future that they're growing up to live into is going to be a wonderful thing. And they see their parents, as you say, as having a major impact on whether that takes place or not.
Yeah. Brian, I see this as the third area of some of the challenges that parents face today, and that is to help children lead purposeful lives, to help children feel that there's a purpose of going forward, that there's a purpose to school, that there's a purpose to good relationships, that there's a purpose to our relationship, and so on.
To help them set goals and to encourage them to believe in the future.
Absolutely. To help them develop that sense of optimism that's so important to manage their day-by-day life.
Yes, and it's so important to realize that you cannot expect your child to have a more positive mental attitude than you do.
And I think that's a part of being a positive role model. And I think that's another challenge of parents today, because we lead such busy lives and there is more to do. And, we see all the time that our workplaces get more and more stimulating. I, for one, could, you know, spend a 20-hour day in my work and get so enthralled in it. And I have to come back and look at my values and say, my child is so important to me. She has to be the primary value in my life, which means that my work life has to be regulated.
Yes, and as you say, the role model that parents offer to their children is perhaps the most important thing that they do. Because what we have found is that children do model their parents. For the first 5, 10, even 15 years of their lives, the children look at what the parent does, and they use that as a guide for their own behavior. They look at the parent's values. They look at the parent's temperament and personality. So being a role model is a critical position that a parent takes.
You know, they say that children don't do as you say. They do as you do. We
yes.
oftentimes have that same model
and
for becoming.
And every parent has had the occasion of hearing one of their little children say something that they had said earlier when they were angry, and they're so surprised that the words come out of their children's mouth, the very words that they used, and no examples need be given on this family tape.
Right. Or for younger children, you know, where they have a pet or where they have toys and dolls and so on, we can oftentimes hear our own values expressed back in our children's world of play.
Yes. And another part of building your children's self-esteem is to be a teacher to your children. The world is a very confusing and scary place to young people. And parents who understand the world because they've gone through those experiences don't realize how much your children need you to teach them the skills and the insight and the knowledge so that they can deal with their reality effectively.
And to give them a really good understanding of the world, you know, I think it's like Walter Cronkite said to me. He said, you know, when you in education provide knowledge and we in the media provide information, but who today in this very different, changing society, who is taking the time, Betty, to do, as you say, help children in their role of learning, growing, and changing? And in today's time, the aspects are different. We do have a drug culture. We do have to help children today to deal with making decisions about being responsible and using or not using, rather, drugs and alcohol and so on.
Yes, and
even understanding the violence on television.
Exactly, or relationships. They need to understand about relationships and friendships. Sometimes you can give them a lot of insights or just even ask them questions about the friends that they have and what's going on in their lives. Sex, drugs, alcohol, chemicals, smoking, work, the speed of change, television. One of the things that we do with our children is we allow them to watch television, but we point out to them that this is not real, that this is adult fantasy. This is sort of like adult cartoons, only it's got people in it. And if you look at television as really being a series of fantasy exercises for adults, just like cartoons on the Disney Channel, children say, is this real? Daddy, is this real? Did this really happen? Did this child get hurt? Or did this act of violence take place? And you say, no, that's just That's just fantasy. That's not real. It's not true. Other than that, they begin to think that the world that they're living in is reflected by what's on television.
Right, and it comes back, you know, to the numbers of skills that parents need today, really, to help children cope with that day-by-day life. And we'll be talking later on in this program about some of the specific skills that parents need to give children so that they can keep their self-esteem up and to a level where they can manage and cope without giving up, without losing hope.
Yes, and some of the foundation activities of parents are to give continuous praise, continuous encouragement, positive reinforcement, to listen empathetically, always be doing the things that cause children to feel good about themselves. And, of course, one of the most important things is to create that emotional environment where they feel secure and they feel loved.
Another one is that children's world really consists of two huge parts, and one is the life the child has with the parent, the bonding, the loving, the needing, the dependency. And the second is his world of work, which is his school life, of course. And so an important part of that is helping children acquire the skills, not only in managing homework and schoolwork, but in just dealing with the school culture, the friends there, the agenda there, and so on.
Yes. You know that a child's self-esteem is very closely tied up with how well they do in school relative to their peers. And we'll talk about this later. But if a child is not taught by their parent how to work effectively and constructively, how are they going to learn? They don't learn at school. Teachers with 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 students in class cannot teach a child how to develop the work habits that are essential to the child's success and therefore their self-esteem. And that's one of the parents' jobs.
Right. Well, you know, Brian, in raising healthy and high self-esteem children, what parents really try to do, the ultimate goal, is to lay a foundation so that children can make choices based upon those values. And we'll be talking throughout this program about some of those.
Oh, yes, and establishing a family philosophy of values that you teach your children and you teach them by living them every single day in your interactions with each other.
Another role of parents is to set positive expectations and realistic ones. We've been talking about some of those facets of self-esteem. We have to remember that areas of emotional security and safety and identity and belongingness are pretty much influenced from the outside world. We give children a good image of their worth, so to speak. But what we're really trying to do in laying that foundation is to take that outer source of motivation and to turn it so that a child will be motivated intrinsically, internally. And when we do these things like expectations, he begins to be able to set goals and to see his own achievements, and from the fruits of that begin to be motivated from internally.
And one of the challenges of parenting today is that children today seem to be having more problems than ever before. And the more research that is done into this, the more they conclude that the fact is, no matter what the parents intend, is that most children today do not feel truly loved by their parents. It's not that parents don't love their children, but children don't perceive it. They don't feel truly loved. They feel that because things are changing so rapidly and parents are busy and the people rush in and out of the house and very little time is spent with them and nobody listens and they don't go to their school or their PTA meetings, children are feeling more and more isolated. And the basic rule is that children have a tendency to react to what is happening to them. And if what is happening to them is positive and constructive and creating a loving environment, then they will react with positive and beneficial behaviors. They'll get good grades in school. They will help at home. They will be fun. They will be supportive. They'll be wonderful children. If children feel unloved, then everything that happens on the black side of the line starts to occur. They become behavior problems. They will be subject to negative peer groups. They will tend to take abusive substances. They won't do their homework. They will fight and argue and be non-cooperative at home. So this is the key. The key always comes back to love. How much does a child feel loved?
And feeling loved is an important part of it. You know, I'm looking at now the recent statistics on dropout around the nation, and the U.S. schools have come back and just point blank said the relationship of students who drop out and low self-esteem is a direct one. And I just finished a national study on looking at why younger and younger and younger children are becoming pregnant from the child's point of view. We want to know what is going on. And do you know the numbers of 13 and 14-year-old children who responded to our questionnaires about what was going on in their thinking? It wasn't that pregnancy was an accident. They said, "I want somebody to love." they saw a pregnancy as literally producing for them somebody to have, somebody to love. And that's a problem that you and I as adults throughout the nation have to look at as it relates to self-esteem, because we can prevent lots of the destructive behavior in children when we focus and when we deliberately do things that raise self-esteem in children.
Well, I think that anyone who is listening to this tape or has listened this far is probably an intelligent, concerned parent that wants to do it better. And so let's lay down the foundation. The foundation for being able to influence your children for good, to make a tremendous positive impact on your children's life, is what we call the love-bond relationship. It's impossible to get your children to do or to not do anything unless this foundation of love has been established. And if you have drifted away from it for a while, you're going to find a remarkable thing. You're going to find that children are not only tremendously malleable, but they're extremely forgiving. And as soon as you start to engage in the behaviors of love and support and praise and encouragement and discontinue the behaviors of destructive criticism and blaming, you're going to find that your children are going to respond like flowers blooming in the sunshine or like roses after a rain. So the key to love is to understand this, is that love, in order to be love, must be unconditional. It must be 100%. It must be given to the child with no strings attached. The child has to know 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that no matter what I do in the whole world, my mother and my father love me totally and unconditionally. That if I screw up, I make a mistake, I do something wrong, they may not be happy about that, but they always love me 100%.
That's right, that they may not approve of the action, but they do not disapprove of me. You know, I'm reminded of the numbers of children who run away from home and who leave home because they feel that there is no connection. They're looking at the numbers of students who drop out, and those children say they believe that the students, that the teachers didn't know them or didn't care about them, that important part. And an important part of feeling that love bond that you talk about is to make sure that our children, in fact, feel it. Because we can say, I love you, until we're blue in the face, but children have long antenna, and they know if we do. And so we have to be sure as parents that our children feel it. I often say to my daughter, rather than saying, you know, just the traditional, I love you, I say to her, you're so important to me. You mean everything to me. And she'll prod me for more. She'll want to say, or she does say, she'll say, why? And what she's saying is, oh, this feels good. Tell me why. Tell me more.
Boy, parenting is such an enormous job. We've just touched on two or three dozen things that a parent has to do in order to raise high self-esteem young people. But the good news is that it's never too late to be an outstanding parent. Is that although parenting is an inexact science, like there are no theories that work, the fact is that you can learn how to be a much, much better parent by taking in the information that we'll present in the following tapes and practicing it day by day, systematically, all the time that you have your children with you, and the net result will be, I promise you, that you will raise high-performance young people who will leave home growing up with a tremendous sense of self-esteem and feeling wonderful about themselves.
Session 2, Four Behaviors of Effective Parents. Why are some parents more effective than others? Why do some parents seem to find more fun and joy in parenting than others? Let's join Betty and Brian to discover the four behaviors of effective, joyful parents.
In the last session, we've been talking about the challenges of parenting and the challenge of parenting in today's times. And in this session, we're going to be talking about the four effective behaviors of good parents. You know, Stanley Cooper Smith, a child psychologist, devoted his life work to the study of self-esteem, Brian, and he researched family conditions that promoted high self-esteem in children. And he found that there were basically three factors that were vital to building self-esteem in children. And the first was that there was just unconditional love by the parents. The second was that children came from backgrounds that provided love without any strings attached. And the third was that children were accepted for who they were. There was a democratic environment, so to speak. And that developing those characteristics is what this session is about.
You know, I don't think many parents really fully understand the ramifications and the meaning of unconditional love. Many parents say, well, of course I love my children. I always love my children. No matter what they do, I love them. But then in their behaviors, what they convey to their children is, I love you when you do things that please me. And when you don't do things that please me, I take the love back. In other words, we have a trade going on here. As long as you do what I like, I'll trade you love. If you stop paying me what I want, which is behaviors that I consider to be appropriate at this particular time, then I take the love back. One psychologist concluded that virtually all of our problems in adult life stem back to love withheld or love deprivation in childhood.
Well, they say that our lives are shaped by those who love us and also by those who refuse to love us.
And a very important point is that unconditional love means this, is that you love the child 100% all the time, no matter what. We have a little game that I began teaching my daughter Christina when she was a child. And I would say, how much do I love you, Christina? And I would train her in this. And then I trained Michael, and now I train David. And she'd say, you love me this much. And she'd hold her hands out wide. And I'd say, but what if I send you to your bedroom? She said, you still love me. And I said, what if I spank you for touching something or doing something? She said, you still love me. I said, what if I spank you and I shout at you and I send you to your bedroom? Now, this is just training. And she said, Daddy, you still love me this much because no matter what, you always love me.
And that is the first of the behaviors of effective parents, and that is that they've made a conscious and total commitment to be a good parent. And the first framework for that is love.
I think it's so important for parents to realize that you don't become an excellent parent just by the act of having children or living with children or working for them or feeding them. You have to make a decision. You have to say, I am going to pay any price, I'm going to go any distance, I'm going to invest any amount of time and energy necessary to learn how to be an excellent parent and to practice it every single day. Because in the absence of that conscious decision, you're going to be a mediocre parent, and you're going to end up having problems with your children that you wouldn't necessarily have to have.
I find that sometimes parents start off with those ideals when their children are little. You know, they look at their infant while he's, you know, in the crib, and you just make promises. You're still thanking God that there are 10 toes and 10 fingers, and you're still blessing, you know, yourself that you have this wonderful child. But then as your child grows and changes, I see sometimes parents back off of those ideals. Are we still playing, you know, patty cake games with our children when they're 10 or 12 and baiting us in to the discussion? And so making a commitment to being a good parent is not just an early childhood decision, but it's one that we have to keep reviewing and evaluating as our children grow and change.
And I don't think parents really realize that having children is the one thing that once you start it, it doesn't end until one of you dies. A marriage may end, a job may end, a career may end, money may come and go. But a child is with you forever. And many parents get so involved in their careers, they get so involved in being successful, they get so involved in external things, they don't realize that, as it was once said, this too shall pass. Everything else will pass and become irrelevant except the quality of that relationship you develop with the child, which you'll have for your entire life.
Well, it is one of the greatest regrets and or one of the greatest joys at the end of our own life. I work with adults who say, you know, the thing that I regret most was that I didn't pay enough attention to my child and to the childhood years, the importance of them. I didn't get enough joy from it. And or they say, the greatest reward I've had in my life, more than my careers, is my relationship with my child.
So the starting point as a parent is to make the decision that you're going to make the efforts necessary to be an excellent parent, not just a good parent or a competent parent, but an excellent parent. And that requires that you study parenting, that you take a parenting course, that you listen to tapes on parenting, that you really think about what it takes to be the parent that your child needs to achieve his or her full potential.
And I see this as a very positive way we're going in American education right now, and that is that parenting courses are beginning to be mandated from the K through 12 years, so that if your child is in 7th grade, many school districts are saying, okay, your child is in 7th grade. We're offering 3 hours of instruction throughout the year. We want you to be there. We expect you to be there. I see it as the only chance parents have for staying with their child, because I often see parents stop coming to their child's school or stop connecting with teachers when kids get older. So you're right, that learning and changing as our children learn and grow and change is an important dimension of being a good parent, of making the commitment to be there.
The second behavior of effective parents is that they create the environment, both the inner and the outer environment, where a child is free to develop to their full potential, where a child is free to become everything they're capable of becoming. And I think there's several ingredients to that. What is the first one?
Well, the first component of that is that they help children feel physically safe. That means both at home and at school, because those are the two primary environments for children. And as it relates to being at home, one of the primary things for children is that when they come home, they feel safe there. Children across the country talk about coming home to an empty house and how fearful it is. We have 63% of our children in the nation coming home to an empty house. We call it latchkey children. And what's important here is that if your child does come home before you do, to provide the safety measures and that your child feel them, Brian, because oftentimes you may think that you live in a safe neighborhood. If children don't feel that, then they don't feel safe.
So what we're really saying is we're talking about Maslow's pyramid, his hierarchy of needs, so that every need needs to be satisfied before the child can go on to the higher level. And the first need is for security, and especially physical security.
Yes, and that second need falls right into that. It is a safety need, but it has to do with the child's emotional well-being. And here the child has to feel that he's not going to be emotionally beat up, that he's not going to be name-called, or that sarcasm isn't going to be part of his reality, that he can feel free to be in an environment without being harmed there emotionally.
And most especially, the child has to feel that when he or she meets his parent at the end of the day, that he's not going to be destructively criticized or run down, that the parent is going to be 100% for them. I call this covering your back. I remember when I was a child, I always had the feeling that whenever I got into an altercation with anyone else, that my parents would take the side of the other person, that it didn't matter what the situation, that I was automatically guilty, and my parents, instead of backing or supporting me or coming to back me up, what they would do is they would support the other person. And so I've made a decision with my children that no matter what difficulties they run into, my first instinct is that I am behind my children 100%. That doesn't mean I excuse delinquencies or things that they do, but I let them know that I'm theirs. I'm 100% behind them as I back them up. And I call this covering your back. So my children always know that their back is covered. And I think this gives a child a tremendous sense of emotional security.
I would add to that by saying that, earlier you were saying parents should read and keep up with childhood and know what's needed at the various ages. Again, I want to come back just a moment to the book Stress in Children. When we looked at what childhood is about and how contemporary society was interplaying with children's needs, we found that there were conditions at various ages, at the various stages of children's lives, that parents need to be more concerned about than others. And I want to give a quick example here. And that would be, let's take the 5-year-old child. Parents need to know a lot about the emotional makeup, the psychology of childhood, so to speak, at the various ages. The primary need for a child at age 5 is what we call bonding. We call it separation anxiety when the child goes to school. But the child has a need to be with the parent and to know about his safety. What that means is that because children watch a lot of television, unfortunately, television has rearranged that separation anxiety fear. And so what children across the nation believe is they believe that it's quite possible in your workday that you could be harmed or even killed. They believe that if you, the mother or father, go home, that someone will come in the window and harm you. That if you go to work in an elevator, something's going to happen to you in the elevator. That if you go into a building that's over 3 stories high, the building's going to be blown up. So what parents need to know for 5-year-olds is that their primary emotional need is for the parent's safety. So parents can move right in and do 2 things right off the bat. One, they can take their child to their world of work and say, look around here, just to give the child a sense of security about that workplace. So the child in his mind can say, gosh, this is quite different than what I see on television. And the second thing the parent can do is to help the child learn the difference between the fantasy and reality, much like you were saying earlier that you do for your children. And the goal here is to erase that unknown fear for your child so that he can feel comfortable. Your child does not enter into the role of a learner until he feels comfortable.
So when we're talking about emotional security, the need for emotional security, I think another dimension, if we want to talk about teenagers, is that when teenagers are going through the tempestuous period of hormones on the rampage as they're going through adolescence and their teenage years, they tend to act sometimes very unstable. They're very moody and emotional. They're angry. They lash out. They're developing their individuality. They're differentiating themselves from their parents. The type of emotional security that a teenager needs is to know that their parents are stable and unchanging, that their parents are not going to react or overreact, and especially that they need to know that even if they act unbearable, even if they act intolerable, even if their behavior is unacceptable, that the parent has an even keel and the parent will continue to be strong and supportive and loving and patient, and no matter how much the parent has to bite their lip, the parent will remain stable while the child is going through the storm of adolescence.
Right, absolutely. I call this staying in your role of a parent. Rather than being baited in to the argument when your child is 15 and becoming 15, and, you know, sometimes that's easy to do. You're now down there on that 15-year-old style communication and getting baited into it. To stay in your role of a parent. Remember that your role and your goal here is to provide the background to learn new behaviors and to emerge with some skills to go the next stage.
And the only way a child can develop fully is by having that emotional and physical security on an ongoing basis, to always know that they're safe, that their base is covered physically and emotionally. But that leads us to the next need, and that's the belonging needs that each child has.
A real key for this is that parents create an environment for their children where children feel like they are there all the time, 100% backing them, much as you said, covering your back. But what this means is that children feel that you will be there. It's an unconditional sort, much like my daughter who said to me, would you still love me if I had to go to jail? Would you still love me if I got pregnant? Would you still love me if? And what they're really doing, Brian, is testing. Teens this age are testing the boundaries of your love. They want to know, would you still love me? Am I still important to you? Am I everything to you?
What I find is that my children want to feel that they're part of a family. They have what they call dependency needs, is they want to feel they're part of a unit. Sometimes my children, my little David was asking me the other day, Daddy, is this your car? Daddy, is this your house? And I said, no, David. I said, this is your car, and it's my car, and it's Mommy's car, and it's Michael's car and Christina's car, and this is your house and Mommy's house and Christina's house and Michael's house. And so I took him around, and I pointed out the pool and the trees and the flowers and the house, and I said, this belongs to all of us. Well, little David just was fascinated by the fact. He says, you mean this is mine too, and this is mine too, and this is mine too? And then he went around for the next few days saying, this is mine, and this is mine, and this is mine, because what he needed to know is that he was not an isolated individual, but that he was a fundamental part, that this was his as much as it was ours.
You know, when children get a good sense that they do belong to you, the parent, they have less of a need for belongingness to outside influences, to outside groups. And it's not until a child pretty much is rejected by the parent that he turns to any powerful source outside. We notice that even when children hang up posters in their room, you can tell where a child is at because who is in the picture is a powerful message to you of who the hero for the child is. And in many cases, it will be you until, you know, you start backing off from your child.
That's why one of the worst things that a parent can say to a child is, as long as you're living in my house, you'll do things my way. Because that what that suggests is that you're simply a visitor here. You're not part of this, that this is my house. It belongs to me. You're sort of like a servant or, if you like, a slave. And that at a certain time, you're going to get out. And when you say that to a child often enough, the child develops a tremendous sense of personal isolation and resentment because they feel completely detached from the only source of true emotional security.
Right. You know, last year, 1.7 million children ran away from home. And when child find agencies located 40%, first of all, 29% were rejected by their parents, which is a new moria for time. Parents abdicating their role of parenting is new. I mean, what could be more hurtful than a parent not taking the child back in and a child feeling that he wasn't wanted? But even when we look at statistics of dropout and so on in schools, children say that they didn't feel like they belonged in the classroom. They didn't feel like the teacher valued them. It had to do with a belongingness needs. We ask elementary children to identify one friend in the school and then one friend in their class. And do you know that 54% of the children in elementary schools are never mentioned once, either in the classroom as a friend or in the school place as a friend? What that tells us as parents is that parents are pretty powerful in children's lives, and we need to be there because when we aren't, children get into big trouble emotionally and sometimes physically.
And so if we satisfy their physical needs, their emotional needs, their belonging needs, then we have to satisfy their self-esteem needs, their need to feel valuable, their need to feel worthwhile, their need to feel respected, their need to feel competent, their need to feel important. And I think this is where we start to get into higher needs. The three lower needs are called deficiency needs, and the higher needs are called self-actualization or self-development needs. I think that the three lower needs are what you might call negative needs, But the higher needs, when you satisfy them, that's when the child starts to really flower.
Well, mostly what happens is that in those first three areas, a lot of messages are sent externally to the child. So the child gets a sense of himself by what others say and do. His price tag, so to speak, is determined by others, what others say and do. And that's why actions are very powerful. But at this now, this new level, this area of esteem and feeling capable and purposeful, what happens is the child begins to send messages to himself of his self-worth. And self-esteem really is the price tag that a child hangs on himself. When educators look at this issue, they see that around fourth grade, many children are beginning to turn their price tag around from being very positive and optimistic. They begin to lower it. And it's because of the messages coming in, which tells us the messages that are coming in take a toll, and they can be either very positive or they can be very hurtful.
Well, we know that children are condemned to what Alfred Adler called the inferiority complex. Because they're small, because so many decisions are made for them, because they're told what to do, because in a way they feel a little bit helpless, all children have an inferiority complex, and there's a thousand forces in their environment that reinforce that. The parent is, in many cases, the only counterforce to that. So the parent always has to be building the child's self-esteem by praise and by encouragement and by expressions of love and by telling the child how intelligent or how funny or how enjoyable or how lovable the child is. The child has an insatiable need to be filled with a sense of his or her own value. And if the parent does that, if the parent supplies that critical need, the child can flower and can develop, if you like, a resistance, like you develop a resistance to a disease, can develop a resistance to the forces that beat down a person's self-esteem when they're growing up.
Right. What happens is that they learn to be capable. They learn to achieve. They learn to excel in this. And the fifth area is helping children feel purposeful, or a sense of mission, as we call it. But they feel like their life matters. Much like you and I, when we go to work, or when we work with groups, or when we work with parents, we have to feel, or even our children, we have to feel that we matter. It matters that we showed up. Children, too, have to feel like it matters.
This leads to self-actualization needs. Self-actualization is defined as feeling that you're becoming everything you're capable of becoming. It's the feeling that you are fulfilling your potential, that you're living on the outside boundary of what you're capable of doing. And it's only possible for a child to strive toward self-actualization when they really feel good about themselves and really feel safe and secure in their primary relationships with their parents.
This is why parents taking a real strong role in helping their children learn how to solve problems and to learn a model for solving problems and to learn how to set and achieve goals, set and accomplish goals, is a very powerful attribute in helping children feel purposeful and capable and self-fulfilled.
And experiencing mastery. You know, I'm always having the desire to jump in and help my children do something that they're struggling with. And then I have to pull myself back, realizing that if the child doesn't have the opportunity to struggle and to overcome adversity and to learn and to actually do it himself or herself, then they can't have that tremendous burst of pride and well-being that leads to self-actualization, that leads to them striving for more and more, rather than playing it safe as they grow up.
Right. Well, and I would caution parents here to be realistic in that, because I see too many parents who believe that letting a child struggle through a problem is character building, when in fact it can be demoralizing to the child if he's not receiving the support that he needs as he struggles through. So a word of caution on that.
The appropriate support for the appropriate
Absolutely.
Child. Well, there's two other needs that Maslow postulated in creating an environment that effective parents do, and they're truth and beauty. The child, even the adult, has the need to know. That's why children are always saying, why? Why this and why that and why this and why that? So it's very important that parents, even if the questions are silly and irrelevant, that parents feed and nurture this desire to know. Because if a child at a young age is encouraged to be curious and to explore its environment, the child's going to do that for life. And the second, of course, is beauty. The enjoyment of a sunset, a flower, a picture, a color, even a picture of a rock star. The children are excited by beauty, and this is a very important thing to instill into a child's environment.
And I believe it's also how we learn to value children. I think that because children have such a need to seek out truth and such a need to seek out beauty, it's part of the charm of children, and I think it's part of how we ourselves as adults finish our own business of childhood by aligning ourselves very closely with loving our children. The third area of being an effective parent is setting high and positive expectations.
Well, that's true, too. Dr. Robert Rosenthal's research at Harvard University over something like 25 years demonstrated that children always have a tendency to fulfill the expectations of the people who are important to them, whether positive expectations or negative expectations. And that if you expect good things of your child and you tell your child that I expect you to do well and I believe in you and I think that you're a terrific child and I know you're going to get good grades, it's amazing how children will do everything possible not to disappoint your expectations.
You know, Brian, it even applies to the school years. For many years in U.S. education, we looked at what wasn't working, you know, what's going on and so on. And then in the last 5 years, we turned that question around and said, look, of the schools that are producing high self-esteem children who are capable and competent and going forward, what is it that they're doing? And there are 10 common characteristics of schools that do things well. And wouldn't you know that the first one is that parents support the child in the role of a learner and set positive and high expectations for the child. And they find that it is the most powerful correlation between a child succeeding in school and in life.
The American Society for Training and Development magazine earlier this year came out with an article looking at motivational techniques that have been developed over the last 50 years. And they concluded unequivocally that positive expectations is still the most powerful and predictable motivator of behavior. That positive expectations expressed toward working people, toward staff, toward employees, toward children, toward spouses, that simply, confidently, and expectantly believing the very best of people causes them to try to do everything possible to prove that you're right.
Right. You know, they say that children live up to our expectations. In other words, self-expectations are a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yes.
Children will live them out, whether they're positive or negative.
Yes, and Dr. Robert Rosenthal's experiments at Harvard University proved that even if the expectations were based on totally false information, they could have an inordinate influence on behavior. And one of the things that he did many times is they would gather all the teachers in a high school at the beginning of the year, and they would give them the names of 7 students. And they would say, these 7 students have been identified as the 7 brightest students in this school. They're all going to be going on to scholarships and leading universities. And we don't want you to teach them any differently. We just want you to know that these students will be going through classes and that they're very, very intelligent. So the teachers would take this list back. And if they had one of these students in their classes, they found that the teachers would be far more attentive to that particular student. They would work with them more closely. They'd respond to them more quickly if they had a question. They would talk to them after school. They would give them extra assignments. They treated them as though they were really, really intelligent. And at the end of that school, all 7 of those students were getting straight A's and were on the honor roll over and over again. And the conclusion that they came to, even though these are just average students, the conclusion that they came to was that a high positive expectations teacher will do more to bring out superior academic accomplishment than any other single factor.
A lot of times parents who are separated from their children will say to me, I live 2,000 miles across the country from my child. Do I have any impact on my child? And their expectations are as important. I sometimes am reminded of the studies where the groups of children were taken into the auditorium. There were 3 groups, and one was taken into the auditorium, and they simply closed their eyes and without a ball, through imagery, were to see themselves as putting that ball through the hoop. And another set who actually went to the gymnasium to practice daily, and another set who went just to the auditorium and imagined that all of this was going on. And of course, the results were that those who imagined it, even they didn't have to be a part of the gym, could in fact experience very high results. Again, the idea that images, even images, have a very powerful influence on our own behavior.
We've had many parents through our courses where we've taught them about the power of positive expectations. And they've gone back to their children's schools, and they've met with their teachers, and they said, we want you to treat our child as though he or she is really intelligent. We want you to talk to him as though he's intelligent. We want you to treat her as though she's talented academically. We just want you to pretend and create this climate of positive expectation. And the parents told me it's quite surprising how cooperative the teachers were. But the most wonderful thing is children that were having academic problems, children that were frustrated in school, started to bloom when their teachers began to treat them as though they were really talented. Then the teachers began to treat other kids the same way, and we've had many teachers come back to us and say they've transformed their classes by just simply dealing with their children as though they've been given a class of gifted children to teach for the entire year. For parents, this is so, so important. As I say, we'll talk about this throughout this course, because it's something that permeates the whole climate of child raising from the time you get up in the morning to the time you go to bed at night.
This brings us to the fourth behavior of effective parents, and that is that there's a great emphasis on communicating with their children, seeking to understand their child, and also that knowing that communication, good communicating, is the link throughout the whole parent-child relationship.
And, of course, communicating is so important that we'll talk about it in subsequent sessions. But one thing that's terribly important in communicating that I had to learn because, again, of my childhood, is that in order to be able to influence your children, you have to be open to being influenced by them. If you want them to do things for you and to be affected by your ideas and your input, you also have to be open to changing your mind. I was brought up believing that a parent never, never admitted that they were wrong, never changed their mind, and never gave in once they had said they were going to do something or once they told a child to do something. What I've learned is that it is not a mark of character to be rigid and inflexible. It's a mark of cowardice, that only the strong parent can admit to the child I was wrong or can say to the child, I changed my mind. Now, my children now come to me and they know that no matter what I've said, if they can present a good case, if they can negotiate, if they can present good arguments, if they can act like lawyers in their own defense, then I'll change my mind because I will do what is fair and reasonable. What am I teaching my children? I'm teaching my children how to be skilled socially. I'm teaching my children how to interact effectively with other people by knowing that they can get their way by thinking through the process, by influencing someone else, by negotiating, by compromising. And by all accounts, these are the most important single skills for success with other people in America.
Yes, and Brian, an important part of that is to be able to say you're sorry. I know that some parents don't want to admit that they're sorry or that they were wrong. And I think it's an important one. I think it sets you up as real, and I think it sets up for children the ability to come to you, too, and say, I'm sorry I said that. Or, you know, if I say to my daughter, I'm sorry I was late, or I'm sorry I said that, that was unfair, then she is more able to say it, too.
And many of the studies show that one of the greatest frustrations that children have with their parents is that they won't admit when they're wrong. When it's obvious that they're wrong, I remember my parent would say if they'd punished me for something I hadn't done, they'd say, well, there's something you probably did that I don't know about. You deserve the punishment anyway. They would never say, I'm wrong. I'm sorry. I made a mistake. But the wonderful thing is that we talk about role modeling, is if you're willing to admit that you made a mistake, then your children can grow up willing to admit that they made mistakes too. If you won't admit you made a mistake, then you're going to raise a child that's going to be just like you. And that's not going to raise a child with self-esteem and self-confidence and happiness and health.
We'll be talking about this whole area of communicating in several other sessions. I think that throughout it all, there's a question that helps us stay on track, and that is, what is my goal? You know, what am I trying to achieve here? What am I trying to teach my child? Does this follow along with my values?
And Dr. Jerry Jampolsky has a wonderful question. He says, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? Do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? In child raising, if we set that as our goal, that our goal is to raise happy, healthy, high self-esteem children, then what we do is we will bend everything else that we do to assure that at the end of this 18 or 19 or 20 years, that our children leave our homes with the self-confidence and self-esteem to be able to go out and take on all the challenges of life.